Are you seeking more depth, more meaning, and a place to connect from the heart with fellow coaches and leaders? Then this is the right place. At Awaken Coach Institute, we create community where you can truly belong and show up as your whole self. Welcome to another episode on the Awaken Voices podcast. Today we have a very special guest. We have author and PhD psychologist Ingrid Clayton, who's done very important work around something called fawning. Fawning is a way that we learn to adjust, please, or disappear in relationships in order to stay safe. It's a nervous system response similar to the known patterns fight, flight, or freeze. But because it often looks like being capable or kind, many people don't realize that it's actually happening and that it's a similar strong response to threat. And understanding this pattern really matters because it shapes how we relate, how we set boundaries, and how much of ourselves we can bring into the world. So together with Ingrid and Christy, they explore how fawning develops, how it lives in the body, and what it takes to come back into a sense of safety, truth, and self-trust. So I really hope that you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed witnessing it.
Ingrid, I'm so excited.
Me too, Christy. So nice to meet you. Oh, gosh.
Reading your book like 500 times. It is so, so good. So good.
Thank you so much.
It's like the story of my life reading this. It's like, oh, I feel seen. I feel heard. I'm sure you hear that from tons of people. What caused you to want to write such a beautiful book as Fawning?
Well, first of all, thank you for reading it and that beautiful feedback. It's like the most meaningful feedback to hear that people see themselves reflected in ways that they haven't before. And I think that really speaks to my personal why, because I also had not seen myself reflected in the countless books and training programs that I attended and therapists that I, you know, and workshops and groups. I mean, I just did all of the things, you know, and in a lot of ways, they reinforced this idea that there was something wrong with me and that I needed to go and fix it. And I was a good student and I wanted to be better and do well. And so I took all the direction. It was like, okay, I have my marching orders. And then I was still stuck. And when that happens, now you really feel like you're broken and there must be something wrong with you. So, you know, learning about fawning as a trauma response, it did two things that deeply freed me. And this was the information that I wanted everyone to have. One is that it puts these behaviors that we've long talked about as codependency or people pleasing, and it puts them in our physiology, right? In the nervous system's response to threat, which means this is not a conscious choice, which is what has been implied forever in this larger conversation about like, well, Christy, just put yourself first, you know, just set a boundary.
Right. As these things just were do amazing. That and you're like all tense and you can't even like remember that you're safe here in your room.
That's right. Like, you don't feel safe, right? You don't feel safe. And so to put, you know, to understand that it wasn't a personal failing in that way, but also because we're talking about relational trauma, it's putting these behaviors back in the context of relationships, right? So I wasn't inherently dysfunctional. My body was responding in ways to protect me from dysfunctional environments. And that's the other piece that had gone missing for so long. So naming the systems, naming systems of power, whether that's your family or the larger systems that we all navigate, It's just like, you know, it blew my mind. It made me make sense to myself. It was unbelievably helpful to my clients. You know, it was sort of this collective awakening. So when I had this opportunity to write this book in particular, it just felt like it makes me emotional every time. Maybe one day it won't, but I felt like my entire life had led up to my ability to articulate this thing from the inside out, both my personal experience and so many of my clients that gifted me with theirs. And I really
believe you did so much. I mean, you've got a doctorate. You've been doing so much therapy with others. And
right.
To think that it's led to a point where the rest of us can read this book and hopefully not have to go through quite so many years as you did of trying to figure it out.
That's right. Yes. Wouldn't that be lovely, right? So here I am in my 50s, and I think about it often, and I hear this from a lot of people, like, what would it have been like if I had this information decades ago? So what a gift that we can give that to people now.
Do you want to say a little more about what is the genius of fawning? Because I love that, you know, I've been diagnosed with depression and generalized anxiety disorder and OCD and like you name it. And it was always treated as if like, well, that's something wrong with you and you need to take medication or take these steps and do things differently and fix yourself. And there was a couple things that really struck me in your book is one, that you wrote your memoir,
yeah,
which I just did also. And talking, there is something about telling your whole story. It's very brave and it puts the context, like you're saying, it's like, wait a second. My 4-year-old self or my 12-year-old self had no context. There was these like vignettes or this, I felt horrible or whatever was happening. But when you're an adult and you write your story, you're like, well, this was the structures I was in. This was the family system I was in. This is the national system I was in. This is what, and once you start writing that down, it's like, pretty genius little person there.
Yes. I think, you know, I could not have written Fawning if I hadn't have spent 5 years writing my memoir before. And so for those that don't know my story, even as a clinical psychologist in private practice who had published before and all these trauma trainings, Christy, I didn't know that I had complex trauma. No one had ever named it for me. So, I was literally called, like struck, I don't know what the word is. It was this powerful thing where I was like, I have to write these stories from my past. And some were from childhood, some were more recent. And to be honest, I didn't even know how they hung together or why, like all these seemingly disparate pieces of my life, I had to get on the page. But it was years and years of doing that where suddenly the connective tissue started to become more visible. And in that process, it truly was the most healing and helpful thing I'd ever done for myself because I could finally see my own story through a trauma therapist's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I had enough distance from it on the page, right? Where I was like, that's what this is. And so that was another piece that really just had me knowing that I needed to publish it because I thought if I have all this information and all this training and I talk about these things all day, every day, and I still didn't know, I couldn't see it for myself personally because of all the self-gaslighting and toxic positivity and spiritual bypassing, all these things that not only was I doing, but they were being reinforced externally. Ingrid, it wasn't that bad. Other people have it so much worse. That wasn't real trauma.
I totally get that. And I think, you know, you talking as a 50-something person and so highly educated and knows so much to say that is a huge, huge gift to the world right there. I mean, I'm 54.
Yeah.
And in my memoir, I couldn't get it either. I'm writing about things that happened when I was 54.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like you're saying, it's like, oh, 2-year-old me and 54-year-old me, no clue. Thankfully, I had a wonderful editor who she just kind of locked herself in a room for a while and was like, okay, you sent me 80 very disconnected stories, but she put them in all these themes. And I was like, oh my goodness. And she's like, I'm missing a story. Something must have happened between here and here. I'm like, yes.
What a gift. Isn't that profound and powerful? Yes, I think similarly through writing groups or through editors or through feedback from readers. You know, I talk about that both, I think, in the memoir and because I bring at least aspects of my personal story into fawning because it's just kind of the spine of that work for me. That part of my healing journey as a fawner who wants, you know, the best for other people even more than for me, I was like, what does the reader need to know? What is the reader? Need, right? That question was such an orienting one. And I was willing to go there to look at things, to sort of like look under every rock for the reader's sake. And honestly, this to me is also one of, you know, if you want to call it the superpowers of fawning, it's like, okay, maybe on one hand, it's to my detriment when I never exist in the equation. But when I'm of service to others in a way that also brings me into focus, I go, well, that's pretty powerful. That's pretty incredible.
Right. It's like a balance of, yes, I have compassion for the other. And yes, I want to understand the other and offer to the other. And the same for myself. You're including yourself as an equal. Because that's the first thing. We're not better than or worse than. We're just equal. And our needs are valuable. And even recognizing, I think you talked in your book about, it's not black and white. It's not like, oh, you should never do any fawning ever.
Yeah, impossible.
No, I mean, same with fight, flight, freeze, any of the other ones. Like, yeah. If you're being chased by a tiger, run as fast as you can. Yes. There are situations. And, you know, if you're in an overwhelming system that you're going to be hurt unless you can figure out how to smile your way out of it.
Yeah, I hope that my body will always turn towards the trauma response that will get me out as unscathed as possible in any given moment. And it's the body that decides. Again, it's not a conscious choice by me. But the point is, we are not meant to live in survival mode all the time, which is unfortunately what can happen when you're dealing with complex trauma, which is ongoing experiences of threat over time. So guess what that reinforces? Ongoing trauma responses all the time. And this too, I think, is why fawning has sort of been hiding in plain sight, wasn't really a part of the discourse until now, is it looks different than the other trauma responses. On one hand, it's not like you're obviously fighting back or leaving, right? Those look like, oh yeah, you're responding to threat. The fawn response looks like leaning in and caretaking and, to your point, smiling and appeasing. And it looks like kindness. It looks like consent. And so people don't see it as a threat response.
And I imagine it's easier to blame yourself for it because it might have felt ish, consent-ish. Or like, did I contribute to this? Or how come I didn't punch the guy or run away? Yeah.
And the shame of that in my personal experience and with my clients is one of the most painful aspects of living with chronic fawning is that very thing. You know, I talk about in the book, I was listening to Dax Shepard's podcast, Armchair Expert, and they were talking about the fawn response. And he was saying that, you know, as a man and certainly as a young boy, he fawned all the time with these stepdads. And anyway, he really related to it. But then he said the shame of that kind of like flattering the guy who literally just, you know, beat his head into the car door or whatever it was. That the shame was worse than anything else. And then he said this, I'm so glad I grew out of my need to fawn. And I'm going, yeah, as a white man, 6'2", tons of wealth and privilege. He kind of did, right? He kind of, from the system's perspective and who holds the power, he didn't have to fawn anymore. And I was just like, oh my gosh, but how many of us, we don't outgrow those systems. We're living.
Well, yeah. And I've outgrown some of them too, but there's some shame attached to it as well, because I'm like, oh, I wish I had had the guts to just leave earlier.
Yeah.
But in some cases, I needed to have the financial stability or the relational friendships outside of the systems that I was leaving before it was possible. And so I think there's a huge amount of just giving ourselves a lot of credit for, like, you didn't do the stupid thing and end up, you know, in a ditch by the side of the road because you
did anything
for it too early. Yeah.
Yeah. I think even just having a little bit of consciousness at all about what's happening is so brave and kind of miraculous, right? Because the body is also like wanting to kind of normalize it and take all the blame and go, well, it's just me and I'm overreacting and I'm being dramatic and there's nothing to see here. So I just,
and especially if that's what you're being told.
That's right.
By multiple people, like, that never happened. That, no, you're exaggerating, or don't make a big deal, or can't you focus on the positive? Those kinds of minimizing, that sometimes the whole system around you will be giving those messages. And
yeah,
you think,
which,
like, am I crazy? Because
the definition
feels bad
of
to me.
Right? Like,
yeah.
And then of course we internalize that and we self-gaslight and we go, you know, maybe I'm being ridiculous. Yeah. So all of these structures are supporting us to stay stuck, stay small, don't fight back. That's the other piece that just feels so important, you know, particularly in this world that we're living in now, where these systems of power almost feel more obvious and abusive than ever before. And you're going, that is real. From every angle that I turn, there's another group, system, person who is benefiting if I stay small and silent and continue to let them hold all the power, which is what they ultimately want at the end of the day. So it's so much bigger than one person's body. I think that's the other thing that takes away the shame. It's not just that my body was doing exactly what it was designed to do physiologically, which is to protect me. And there's no dysfunction in that. It was also residing in a world that continues to condition, expect, applaud, right? Like, keep doing what you're doing, stay small and silent and hold and be the glue that holds it all together and do it with a smile.
It's such a kind way of putting it, because I can get really angry too at, like, why are so many of us women upholding systems that are so bad for us? And seemingly doing it wholeheartedly. Like, you know, you see so many women these days talking about, like, oh, don't you want the strong man? You know, when you're like, grabbing people by the pussies, not my idea of a strong man, you know, or, you know, whoever you want to talk about, the men doing horrible things. And a lot of times it's us women who are appearing to uphold it. And I'm wondering, like, are we just all, millions of us, trained in fawning?
And the answer is yes. The answer is yes, right? It reminds me of one of the clients I talk about, Lily, in the book, who's Hispanic, and that she was raised from a little girl to know that her power and worth lied in her proximity to whiteness, right? Like, who you marry, if they're lighter skinned, your kids are going to be lighter skinned. Like, how much can you pass? And the same is true for women. Like, our power has historically been in relationship to the men in our lives who hold all the power, and how you can, you know, be the strong woman by their side, or, you know, a million different ways to look at it. And so I can see it from both sides. I go, yeah, if that has been your only relationship to having any power at all, any agency at all, is by first pleasing and caretaking the men in your lives. That's my entire childhood experience, right? I knew that. I knew that I did not like my stepdad, but I needed him to like me. And my body found a million ways to try to, you know, hold up the latter piece of that. And so do countless.
Some kids have to. You don't have any power. I mean, you are powerless as a child. You need food and shelter, like, to stay alive.
That's right.
And I think you live in that for long enough, even as adults. Like, I really try to give myself tons of compassion that, like, okay, I'm in my 50s and still figuring this out.
Yeah.
Because it's the whole world we're living in. It's not just, it's like you said, it's not an individual. How come I'm the only woman on earth who's not as powerful as I could have been, or, you know.
And most of us were conditioned as children, right? If you think about just what it means to be feminine is to be sweet and to be caretaking. And it's like you take a lot of those adjectives and you can place them under fawning, and you can place them under what it means to be in a female body, what we've been told it is anyway. So it's a lot to tease apart. And again, it's operating without our consent, our conscious awareness. We believe it's just who we are, or it's how it is. And that's why it took me 5 years to sort of name all of these things until I could finally start to see it with enough distance from another perspective. It is a lot to crawl out from under. It also makes me think about complex trauma generally and the difference between acute traumatic events. That for complex trauma, there is no before and after for many people.
Right. Like, can I remember feeling safe, or people are like, go back to the time you felt safe. And it's like, you know what? For Dobson kids who were spanked from age 4 months onward, there wasn't. When was that safety? Mm-mm.
So we don't even have the contrast in our bodies, which is where real learning happens. It has to be experiential. So we can have all these ideas and these theories, and I'm smart enough to go, well, yes, setting boundaries makes sense. But if I don't have that architecture mapped into my body at all from day one, we have to acknowledge that these are two different languages, what we think and what the body knows. And we can't keep prescribing these things that sound so logical and make perfect sense and shame people for not doing it. When the body goes, I don't even know what you're talking about. In fact, you're ridiculous. You're going to walk me right into fire and I'm not going to do it. That's why I think, again, this lens and language of trauma generally is so important, because it speaks to the somatic embodied experience versus just, you know, what we think we know about a thing.
Yeah. My favorite chapter, I mean, I just loved all the chapters and bent all the pages, but my favorite one was the magic of trusting yourself. I just want to read a tiny bit here. It says, unfawning can feel contrary to the rules you've followed your entire life. The hierarchies we are living in have reinforced the idea that we can't trust ourselves, that we're bad, sinful, or selfish, that we have to be controlled. So moving out of chronic fawning means restoring the sacred relationship to ourselves. Our bodies have an inherent wisdom that truly wants us to heal. And then you talk about some practices, and they're so elegantly simple. If you want to just say a little bit about orienting, or maybe a couple other ones that are just easy and helpful. Not that they're easy, but they're simple.
Yeah, they're accessible, I think, right? Yeah. For anybody, which feels so important. Yeah. Well, thank you for reading that. I haven't read it maybe since I wrote it, and it's lovely to have it reflected back. I'm like, yeah, that's what it is. Well, I'll just start by saying a little more context as to why these are so helpful. So if you, like me, have lived in a chronic fawn response, your entire sense of safety resides outside of your own body.
Right. Who's going to like me? Who's going to take care of me? Who's going to rescue me? Where am I safe? Safety is out there. This feels scary inside. And so,
safety lies out there. And if it's out there, guess what? It's always at arm's length to me. So the biggest change in terms of growing a sense of self, maybe for the first time, of trusting yourself, is restoring a relationship to yourself. And so Peter Levine, he's the founder of Somatic Experiencing, trauma therapy. And his work was really born from looking at animals in the wild, right? Like, how do they navigate threat? Because they're navigating it day in, day out. Why aren't they all traumatized like us? And
they're all shaking it off.
Right. And so, yeah, shaking it off is one piece of it. But also, it's that the language of the nervous system is the senses. So when you think about animals in the wild, or even your cat, you know, it's like they are aware of what's happening all the time. They're connected to the earth. We are so disconnected, right, through our phones and through our autopilot, and we're multitasking, and it's like we don't even know where we are half the time. So this deep connection to present time and place through the senses allows the body to go, it's not theoretical, like, oh yeah, I'm safe. I know I'm safe. The body knows, oh, I'm safe because there is no threat happening right now, because I can feel my feet on the ground. I use my eyes, and people can do this in this moment and notice how you feel, which is look around your environment and just literally notice what you see. Our field of vision, when we are dysregulated, when we're triggered, when we're traumatized, goes super narrow. So just taking a moment to widen the field and let your body know what exists to the right and to the left, it tells your body, oh, I'm safe right now. And then you might notice something. I tend to like to orient towards natural things, and there's plants outside my window. So I go, oh, green leaves, and it rained this morning, and I can notice the drops. Orienting to the natural world also creates more of a sense of containment, that, again, that safety. It's not just me, but it's me and the earth. And then similarly, you engage all of the senses, maybe one at a time, and you might notice that you prefer one over the other. What do you hear? There's a plane flying overhead right now. What do I smell? What do I taste? What do I feel? It's why we have things like a touchstone, or you might like your fidget spinners or your things that kind of help you feel like that tactile sense of regulation. So all of these things are about regulating your nervous system, coming into present time and place. And I say, practice this. Do it all the time so that your body has a sense of it. Do it daily. But then when you are triggered, when you're overwhelmed, when you're dysregulated, that's the time to do it again. And maybe you'll have the muscle memory to do it because you've practiced it in other moments.
It's a huge sense of power, at least it is for me. Like even earlier today, I was getting stressed. There's some financial stuff going on that I was worried about. And so, of course, I imagined myself like homeless on a park bench or something. And so then I'm like, okay, my friend. And it helps me to move really slowly, very, very slowly, just kind of, I was sitting right on that couch, and I did just look really slowly, like, there's my warm, glowy lamp, there's my plant, and then my body is telling me, you live in a really comfy, beautiful home, you have got plenty of extra income to go buy yourself a plant if you want to. And it's not that I'm saying those words to myself even, but it's just like I've got some gorgeous little objects and my little hugging sloths, and you know, and the body. And there's something about being able to go from muscle tension to really deep inside relaxation in a matter of second, that and that you know you can always come back home whenever you want, that it's like, okay. Because I used to end up in the hospital with the sciatica or heart palpitations or like you name it. I would be, you know, having these really extreme reactions.
Yes.
And now, just knowing a few of these somatic experiencing trips, I'm like, I'm not ending up in the hospital. I can do in 30 seconds little things, lean into my heels instead of on my toes.
Wow.
Feel my back body, feel my spine twist. 30 seconds, and it's like, oh yeah, I'm home in here.
The other thing you've done so many times when you're telling me this, keep putting your hand on your heart, which is one of my favorites. And I tell people if you can do it skin to skin, you get your hand right on there. It's what we do with babies when they're born. We put them right on our heart. We nuzzle them in our neck because it releases oxytocin. So we can release oxytocin by ourselves for ourselves just by doing that very thing, this hand on heart stance of self-compassion. And then I tell people, listen, experiment. Like, I love what you were just saying too. Can I feel my back? Can I have some, can I breathe into my back? And I list lots of different things that my clients do and have tried because they each have their own variety and flavor of things. Like one is like music is my go-to and I have my playlist that I love. And one is like scented candles are my jam. And I love going for walks. Walking is bilateral stimulation, which is right-left rhythmic patterns. It's a cornerstone of EMDR therapy. It helps process, you know, from right to left brain. So I like this little combo platter of go for a walk around my block, orient to nature, and move my body right-left as I'm doing it. It's like I always come back a different person. It doesn't change the external factors in my life. It changes my ability to show up for them in a more regulated way. And what that ultimately means is I have more access to this conscious, logical part of my brain so that I can use it more effectively. And so the combination of all of these things, it really adds up to your point. It is, they sound kind of simple, but I see them move the needle every time.
Yeah. So a little bit of a change in focus here. We've been talking about fawning and you brought up relationships. This season of our podcast at Awaken is focused on love. And we're always about true spirituality. And love is just so expansive. And it starts with how can I be with myself? And then how can I be with you right here in this conversation, open-hearted? We've already had a very trusting conversation, even though we're meeting for the first time from a distance away. But how open can we be if the person is trustworthy? How does it expand? How does love come into play for you, learning to unfawn?
It's such a huge question. I could go in 8 million different directions, so I'll just speak to the ones that came into my mind first. One is that, you know, for myself and a lot of my clients, because I work with childhood trauma, is that our definitions even of love have been deeply contaminated because abuse coexisted with love, neglect and love. And so the body starts to go, oh, this is what love is, right? It comes with this like deep sacrifice. It comes with pain. And there's a saying, I don't know who said it, but I've quoted it a million times, which is red flags don't look like red flags when they feel like home. And so what a lot of us are doing is untangling these ideas, right, through intergenerational trauma and personal experience of what we thought love was. And I believe that a way into a new definition is starting with this return to self-trust, that the deeper that I come into my own body, again, that restoring that idea of all my safety and sense of self even resides in what you think of me, to pivoting and going, wait a second, who am I? How do I feel? What do I need? What sensations am I experiencing? What's it like to truly love myself? Not with this like idea of what I thought that was, but you know, because we can also talk about self-care, like, oh, well, you know, go and spend a bunch of money and, do something for yourself. But sometimes self-love
but you're
looks...
You're talking about this in the moment, like moment-by-moment awareness. What do I need right now? Not in general, but like, what does this human body need right now?
And often what people find when they tap into themselves for the first time, it doesn't feel like this magical idea of love. It feels like terror. It feels like pain. It feels like this is numb. And so what I like to tell people is you're on the right track, that you're not doing it wrong. It often feels bad before it can remotely even feel neutral. And the question then becomes, can I be a witness to whatever I'm experiencing and notice that? Wow, you're noticing that you feel numb. What's it like to notice that? So there's no wrong, right? You're not like off track, like I said. So we go, oh my gosh, can you tolerate feeling that pain a little bit more? If it's too much, it's like turning down the volume knob. Maybe it feels like it's at a 9 and you need to flee it. What if we could turn down the volume to a 2? Could you stay present to it there and maybe put your hand on your heart while you do? This is being in true relationship to self. And guess what it automatically does? It changes my capacity to be in real relationship with someone else.
That I like to say truth and love are such close cousins. They can't really be separated. And that's what I hear.
Yeah.
Not using the word truth necessarily, but like that noticing this is reality.
Reality is the word that often comes to mind. Yes, it's what's real. It's what's happening. And it's a big shift. I think for those that do identify as fawners, we thought we have been so connected to others because we've been so probably hyper-focused on them, but that is not real.
And holding out such hope for they're going to change.
Yes.
They're going to be better. Heaven is, tomorrow is just a day away and you're so hopeful. And it feels like that should be loving. And then when you switch that on its head and say, no, it's actually more loving to say, this is real. This is what's happening. This is the boundary that is truthful because this is how my body feels.
Yes.
It doesn't have that sort of soft and fuzzy quality of love that some people want, but there's something really loving about honesty.
Yes, 100%. And so it can be a radically different orientation. And yet, with all of this work, even as I'm saying, you know, that you're facing real fear, you're facing real grief, maybe for all the time that you lost when you thought that that was love and you thought that was connection and you thought you were present and you realized that none of it was true, like the grief that we have to go through. And
writing your memoir, that can't have been fun and easy to tell the truth because it feels like, wait, I should be minimizing this or somebody else's story. They're not going to see it that way. Or at least that's how it was for me. Like, this is terrifying. Like, I'm still crying just thinking about it coming out.
You know, it was years and years of me writing it. And I still thought as I went to publish it, are people going to tell me my greatest fears, which is like, Ingrid, it wasn't really that bad, right? Like, really, you know, of course I felt that way because that's been the response to my story my entire life. I think that idea that, yes, we have to face all this pain. And yes, writing my memoir was the most healing, but it was also the most painful because I had to drop into the reality of those things and finally metabolize what actually happened. It was like, yes, it did actually happen. And look at all this pain that's just been sitting here, you know, unfelt, even though I had told the story a million times. It was like I hadn't really ever dropped in. And that dropping in, I mean, is hard. And yet, This is where I turn to Rezma Menakem's work, The Difference Between Clean Pain and Dirty Pain. That yes. dirty pain of circling that drain my whole life, of it's not that bad and I've got it and I'll just figure it out and I'll fix it, versus this clean pain of finally actually metabolizing it and feeling how brutal it was the thing that finally brought me to the other side. And so I go, yes, it's hard. Yes, it's painful. And this is why it's worth it. Because it has forever changed my relationship to myself. It has changed my relationship to everything, to my work, to my friendships, to my relationship with my husband and my son. It has changed my ability to be more present, my capacity to hold difficult things in this very difficult time. Oh my gosh, it's beyond worth it to me.
And you've got this love relationship with your husband and you are able to love your son. What's that like?
Profound. I mean, I will say motherhood has challenged me more than anything else in my life, particularly as a childhood trauma survivor. My son was very little when I started writing the memoir, and I think that he was also a catalyst becoming a mother and being like, well, wait a second, you know?
I wouldn't do that to my kid, yeah.
The bumping
Even if
up.
They're screaming and like, yeah, they can be very triggering.
Very.
Kids make a lot of noise and mess, and you still find it in yourself a good amount of the time to figure out how to regulate.
But I wasn't, I think, was the point initially. I was just a triggered mess. It was like, what is going on? And again, that's partly what led me to being able to say, like, oh, right, this is trauma. We all want to use our story as like a measuring stick. Like, well, was it that bad? Does that entitle me to the word trauma? What entitles us to the word trauma is our symptoms now, you know, our dysregulation now, our feeling so stuck now. And so that was big for me. And so part of my ongoing work, particularly as a mom, is, you know, with his each stage of growth and development, it challenges me to have to grow more and more into those parts of myself and regulate harder and grow my capacity for unconditional love even more. And I miss the mark all the time. And then I have to go to him and say, oh, I missed the mark there, right? I have to own it when it happens and offer that repair. It's not that we never rupture, right? Most of us know rupture like the back of our hand. What we didn't get was the repair piece. And so I'm also really committed to that. The same is true with my husband. I think the best thing about our relationship is that he can call me on my stuff in a way that I can see is so true. And he continues to do it in this really loving way where he can almost make me laugh at it as it's happening. And I go, oh, yeah, I was being a jerk there. And then we can kind of laugh and move on. And so there is this radical honesty, but it doesn't always have to be this like, can we sit down and have a really heavy conversation? It's just a part of the fabric of our day-to-day life. So it's an ongoing privilege and a practice with my family is what it feels like.
That's so truthful. That's what love is. It's that day in, day out, showing up, apologizing, laughing at ourselves, doing a little better, just doing a little worse.
Yeah. And I love that you say doing a little worse because sometimes that's what it looks like.
Yeah. And what about if you want to say anything about a deeper spirituality or bigger love, even than the self or the relational love, what more do you find?
Me moving from a memoir, which was all about untangling this internal experience, to writing about fawning that included both my clients, but just this larger systems awareness, I really feel like it allowed me to see this connective, like, so the memoir was about the connective tissue between even my childhood and my adult self. And fawning is about my connective tissue as someone who has a body, as someone who has had trauma, but also just generally felt disempowered, to everyone else who has had that experience. It was a really powerful takeaway from writing the book for me. And in some ways, I still feel a little embarrassed to admit it. Like, really? You had to like write the book to feel like more connected to anyone who's been disempowered and, you know, people of color or, you know, all of classism and ageism and ableism and all these things. But it really did. It made me go, oh my gosh, I will never know what it's like to be a person of color. But for those that have turned to fawn in response to, you know, white privilege, I go, well, there is a connection there where I really understand what that feels like. And I think because this overly medicalized and individualized model where everything has boiled down to an individual having to pick themselves up by their bootstraps. Listen, I'm a therapist, so I'm not going to dump all over therapy, but I do think there's a big loss there in terms of what needs to happen on a larger, more community, communal aspect. And this book has allowed me to see the truth of that in ways where I know my healing isn't just for me. Right? My healing has to be in service of helping us all get more free. Not just like, how do I survive these systems, but how right. can I grow up and hopefully create more change? And that's why I stay on social media talking about these things as a therapist. It's why writing feels powerful because I can reach more people than the one-on-one work in my office. And so I feel more committed to that than ever before and committed to learning and staying open to how else, you know, if we're growing our capacity again, it had to start with me, because if I don't have any capacity, how can I show up in the greater landscape of things? But as I grow that, my question has to continue to become, and now what, right? What am I going to do with that true privilege that I have, even of healing? I don't know what question you asked, but I took off in that direction. And you can tell where my heart is today, I think.
Exactly. Well, Ingrid, thank you so much for writing your book and putting it out there with all of your generosity of spirit, and for letting all of us know that we're not alone, that we are loved, and that we do collectively have power.
Yes.
To speak the truth and change our systems and choose love, choose honesty, choose reality.
Reality, yes, yes. Even when it's hard. Like we have a lot of that right now, but I'm glad, and in a way I'm glad we're seeing the truth of what's always been true, but maybe we wasn't as visible. Because now we can engage with it. And so that's the ongoing work. And it was so lovely to meet you. And I'm so grateful that we connected. I truly wish you and anyone else who has written their personal story as much healing as mine has brought me. And that includes the putting it out there piece and getting the feedback from readers. There's such a richness to it, which you already experienced with the editing process alone.
I hope so. It's so scary putting it out there. I think the thing that helped me the most is that my editor anonymized a lot of stuff. And so when I read it through after the editing process was finished, like my best friend's names had all been changed and the name of the school I went to and this and that. And there was something about reading it with, it's almost like it was every man, every little girl. And it really helped me because I'm like, you know what? There were millions of us.
Yes.
Who had this experience. And my name is Christy. You could change the name. You could change the location. But we're human beings having these experiences, and everybody's story strengthens everyone else. So it felt selfish in some ways to take the time to write it. And let's just hope all of our stories are such a gift out there. And I hope both of our writings continue to be that. I am so appreciative of you, Ingrid. Is there anything else that you feel like we all need to hear from your lips today?
I mean, the thing that always comes to mind when I'm asked that question is just, you make sense. I'm sorry if you've never felt that way or no one told you before. I just want you to know you make sense. I hope that you can know that experientially, not just theoretically. But yeah, that's the piece that usually rises to the top for me.
Yeah, it does make sense. And thank you for supporting us and trusting our bodies and joining together to make this world better.
Thanks, Christy.
Thank you, Ingrid. I think we went too.
Awake, hear the voice.